This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Discuss the impact on a person by the act of falling rather than where you are. We said you can have two people. One is at a far lower status than another, far lower level, whether it's a financial level or a social level or a religious level or a spiritual level. The one on a higher level might have been damaged more, might be more damaged because he came from a still higher level. What's important is how far you've fallen, not where you land. And the measuring of the impact of the fall becomes critical in understanding people's feelings, people's fragility, and people's response and reaction. One of the examples of fall, of rejection that we discussed, was that of one of Naomi's two daughters-in-law. She had two daughters-in-law, Ruth and Orpah. She leaves her land, leaves the land of her family, and returns after the death of her husband and two sons to Israel. Her two daughters-in-law want to come with her. She dissuades them both, talking to them both using exactly the same words. She talks to them in the plural. She puts them in exactly the same position. The communication that Ruth and Orpah receive from Naomi is identical. They respond differently. We can choose to respond to communication the way we want to. Not everybody responds to communication in the same way. So one communication is given to two women, they respond in opposite ways. Orpah says, if you don't need me, I'm going. And that night she descends to some of the lowest levels of depravity. She involves herself in relationships with 100 men, we're told, and even an animal, a dog is involved in the whole scene as well. A completely depraved sexual scene takes place that night. Ruth chooses not to be rejected. We spoke about that too. One can choose to be rejected, or one can choose to allow oneself to be rejected, and one can choose to cleave. The problem with choosing to cleave is that you're imposing yourself on the other person. He's trying to get rid of you, and you're choosing to cleave. And that creates a problem. And we said the method of dealing with that is to make sure that your cleaving to the other person is a pleasure to him, and not a drain to him. To make sure that you're cleaving to him or to her in a way that adds to them and does not diminish them, does not detract from them. And that's what Ruth chose to do. She chose to cleave to Naomi in a way that enriched Naomi. It didn't impoverish Naomi. And we spoke about the Gemara, dealt with the whole question of cleaving to God. How do you do that? And doing that through relationships with godly people. And how do you develop a relationship with a godly person? You invest in that relationship in a way that enriches him but doesn't impoverish him. And out of that rejection and sense of loss and fall that Orpah has, there comes the inevitable tendency to justify one's own situation by becoming jaundiced and angry at the rest of the world. And that sometimes translates into destructiveness, sometimes into negativity, and sometimes into arrogance. I'm really okay, everybody else is just going up. I'm being left behind. And that translates into Orpah's descendant, her son according to some, who is Goliath the giant, the Philistine giant. Ruth's descendant is David. And we're looking at, in chapter 17, at the conflict between these two personalities. The personality formed by a woman who became depraved as a result of rejection and disappointment and fall, and the descendant of a woman who elevated herself to the greatest heights by choosing not to be rejected, by choosing to cleave, by choosing to stay attached to that which she considered valuable. Now what we're going to do is get into the text a little bit and look at some of the insights that result from doing so. the statement in the third verse, in verse 3, the Philistines were standing on the mountain on one side, and Israel was standing on the mountain on the other side, and the valley was between them. So we have here an image not only of the layout of the battle, but you've got the Philistines on one hill, and the Jewish people on the other hill, ready to wage war. But there's a sense of the unbelievable chasm between these two nations. They are on the one hill, the Jews are on the other hill, and there's a valley between them. There's an unbridgeable gap between these two civilizations. Vayetze Ish HaBeinayim, in verse 4, translated in the English very poorly as a champion went forth from the Philistine camps. The word Ish HaBeinayim literally means a man from in between. And there are two ways that that's treated, the man from in between. The one way is Rashi's interpretation, which I will read to you. Rashi says the Ish HaBeinayim is a gibor leitzei mimarachtoi lamoid ben shnei hamaruches. The hero who left his place of comfort to stand between the two formed battalions. So while everybody was comfortable in their own camp, and no Jew budged and no Philistine budged, Goliath was the first person to take a step out into the open and to say, let's engage, let's sort this out. And he's talked not disparagingly in that sense, Ish HaBeinayim, in a complimentary sense, somebody who took a step into the breach, stood in the middle and said, let's deal with this issue, let's challenge it. The Targum Yonason, which I've explained to you before, is the most authentic biblical translation from many, many centuries ago into Aramaic. Talks about it in a slightly different sense and says more that he is Ish HaBeinayim, from among them, as powerful as he was and as gigantic as he was. He wasn't the king of the Philistines, he wasn't the general, he was just an ordinary Philistine who took it upon himself to walk out and challenge the Jewish people. He is completely impenetrable. If we read the description of his armor, in verse 5, he had a copper helmet on his head, he was wearing an armor of mail, the weight of the armor was 5,000 copper shekels, he had a copper shield on his legs and a copper neck guard between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and the blade of his spear weighed 600 iron shekels. The shield bearer walked before him. So this is a man who is dressed in an armor that cannot possibly be penetrated. Massive, huge, with this huge sword. And another person holding his shield. His shield is so big and heavy that he doesn't even hold it himself. He has a shield bearer standing in front of him. He's totally impenetrable. And he comes along with this absurd challenge. And what's his challenge? He says in verse 8, Vayamoed Vayikra Malchus Israel, and he stood up and called out to the battalions of Israel and said unto them, why are you going forth to wage war? What is this business? We're all fighting, every one of us getting into battle. Am I not the Philistine while you are the servants of Saul? Once again he is saying, I'm just an ordinary person, and I'm a free person. In our civilization we don't have slaves and servants. You are committed to this king of yours. Choose yourselves a man and let him come down to me. Now does that make sense? He's standing, true, he's moving towards the valley, and that could mean what he's, when he says come down to me. But at the end of the day, he's massive. He's more than 9 foot tall, we said. He's enormous. What is this, choose a man and let him come down to me? Once again, two interpretations as to what that means. The Medrash interprets that when the term Ish is used, man, with a capital M in a sense, it's referring to God. Brumachem Ish, bring your man, bring your power, bring your personality, your godly personality, and let him do battle with me. Through one of you. In other words, let this be a battle of gods. We believe in the forces of idolatry, you believe in God, let's sort out who's right. But we don't have to, the whole nation doesn't have to engage in a battle. Whoever is the stronger God will support two people fighting as well. So why don't you appoint one person to come and fight on behalf of God? I will fight on behalf of our idols, and let's see what happens. And the other implication is Ish, the man being referred to here, is Shaul. Let Shaul come. He's your king. Let him come and do battle with me. There's no reason for the entire nation to risk war, to risk death, when I could engage directly with Shaul. Then we're told, if he can fight me and kill me, we will be slaves to you. And if I defeat him and kill him, you will be slaves to us and serve us. It's a ridiculous suggestion. The man is gigantic and impenetrable. What chance does anybody have against him, one individual, have against him? Then the Philistine said, I have disgraced the battalions of Israel this day, saying, give me a man and we will fight together. So if it's so ridiculous, why is he saying it? What's the point of the suggestion? Clearly it's going to be turned down. All he's saying it is embarrassment. I have put out an offer. Come, man to man, appoint one man. Do you have anybody great enough? We value physical strength. You value intellectual and spiritual strength. So bring your great man and let him fight our great man and let's see what's stronger. Let's see whether physical strength or spiritual and intellectual strength has the greater hand. And why is he doing it? He makes it very clear why he's doing it. I have disgraced the battalions of Israel this day, saying, give me a man and we will fight together. Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, and they were terrified and greatly afraid. Then, verse 12, David was the son of a certain Ephrati, man from Bethlehem, Yehuda. We already met him. His name was Yishai, and he had eight sons. In the days of Shaul, the man was old and would come among the elders. Jesse's three oldest sons left home and followed Shaul to war. So in Shaul's army, there were three sons of Yishai, brothers of David. The names of his three sons who went to war were Eliab, the first, the second to him, Abinadab, and the third, Shammah. But David was the youngest. Just the three oldest followed Shaul. David would travel back and forth from Shaul's presence to tend his father's flocks in Bethlehem. So you remember, David was hired to play music for Shaul when Shaul felt depressed. But Shaul had obviously not engaged in any conversation with David, hadn't in any way related to him as an individual, didn't really know him. The Philistine would approach the Israelite camp early morning and evening. He presented himself for 40 days. That's a phrase that rings in our ears. Let's look at it in the Hebrew. Vayigash haplishti hashkem v'harev. Plishti would come every morning and every evening by Yisyatsev, and he would stand Arbeim Yom, 40 days. Why does it ring a bell? 40 days? That's a meaningful number for us. What's 40 days? Moshe on Sinai. And morning and evening? Just the times we go to shul. Just the time every Jew is supposed to be in shul davening, along would come Goliath and start thundering from the hills. And distract them and disrupt them. And his intention, say Chazal, was to distract them from doing exactly that. What he didn't want to happen was that they should be saying their Shema every morning and every evening. Let me find you the section. Amru Rav Hussein, says Rashi, Kedei Levatlon Mikriya Shema. His intention was to distract them from saying Kriya Shema. Now that's quite fascinating for a number of reasons. It is interesting that the Philistine Goliath knew that to destroy this nation he had to stop them saying Kriya Shema. We don't know that. We think we can survive without it. We think it doesn't matter. We think we can carry on as normal without it. And the Philistine knew that it was essential to get them to stop that practice. Because in that practice, What is Shema? Shema is the recognition of the unity of God despite the diversity of the situations in which we find ourselves. I've spoken at a number of shiurim recently about the paradox of Jewish existence, that we operate in a multiplicity of worlds, at least in a duplicity, and sometimes in a multiplicity of worlds. And what's unique about us is not that we believe in one God. Lots of nations believe in one God. What's unique about us is that we function in a duplicity, at least a duplicity of worlds, and in that duplicity we have one God. That we retain one value system wherever we are. That we don't go through a complete personality change as we move from one world to another. Our means of operation change as we move from one world to another. Our strategies for survival and for prosperity change as we move from one world to another. But our value system never changes as we move from one world to the other. That's Shema. And a Jew has to do that twice a day. You need to remember that part of the duplicity, the paradox of our existence, is nighttime and daytime. And the things, the strategies for the day are different to the strategies in the nighttime. You feel different at night, you dress differently at night, you seek different activities at night. It's a very different kind of existence in the daytime and the nighttime. And it's very important that before you go out to dinner on an evening, you remember that you're governed by the same God that governed you this morning when you had your tefillin on in shul. It's very important that when you're sitting in shul in the morning about to go out to work, you remind yourself that you're governed by the same God that governed you last night when you were sitting in a shiur. That no matter what situation you're in, the God doesn't change, and therefore the value system doesn't change. Your lifestyle changes, your fashion changes, your being in tune with the world changes. It's for the fact that we have to constantly adapt to a changing environment that we need to say Shema. We say Shema not because we're dogmatic and inflexible. We say Shema because we are the ultimate of flexibility. That when we're in business, we're the best business people. And when we're in the professions, we're the best at our profession. And when we're studying the Torah, we're the best at the Torah. And when we're praying, we're the best at prayer. And we're very different in those situations. What you need to do when you're praying is very different to what you need to do when you're working in your business. It's a different way of thinking. It's a different type of activity. It's a different strategy. Same value system, same value system, same value system. That's the Jew. And our strength rests in being able to do those two things. Because if we lose the stability of our value system, the constancy of our value system, then we have to become dogmatic in our lives. Otherwise we have no security whatever. We're just floating around like a jellyfish. If we lose the flexibility in our lives, then we lose the need for a value system, for a single unitary value system. The two are absolutely in need of being in balance. We have to have them both. That's what typifies the Jew. So our ability to remain focused, to remain morally focused every morning and every evening, is the key to our flexibility. We can allow ourselves to be free and flexible during the day and the night because we're secure in the fact that we have a value system. We know where we're going morally. If you know where you're going morally, you can be free to explore anything you want because your moral compass is on focus. Once your moral compass comes into question, and every time you're doing something you've got to re-question your moral focus, then the only way you can find security is in inflexibility. This is what I do every morning. This is my routine every afternoon, every evening. This is what I feel secure in. This is what I feel comfortable in. And Goliath knew that by destroying that focus, that moral focus, the Jewish people would be at a disadvantage. And so he would wait till Shacharis time, the time for morning prayers, and he would get up and thunder from the mountain. And then during the day, when the Jews were busy with their business, he would go home. He had no business with them. Just when they're ready for Ma'ariv, back there he is, starting to terrorize them and to distract them from their davening. He does it for 40 days. The Midrash says for 40 days because there's only one force with which Goliath can be battled. Goliath cannot be battled with anything physical because of his armor. They didn't have any ammunition capable of penetrating that armor. So the only thing that could penetrate it is Torah. And we'll see how that was done. You know the beautiful story of Rabbi Akiva, one of the greatest sages we've had ever. Even Moshe, we're told, was almost jealous of the brilliance of Rabbi Akiva. When he foresaw the innovative qualities of Rabbi Akiva, Moshe got worried. And Rabbi Akiva started off the first 40 years of his life. Not only was he ignorant of anything in Torah, he had a passionate hatred for religious Jews, for the Jewish religion, for Torah, for all of that, a passionate hatred. And he used to say, if I would come across a Talmud Chacham, remember we described the Talmud Chacham last week, if I would come across a Talmud Chacham, I would eat him, I would bite him like a donkey. When my father used to explain that Gemara, he used to say, I didn't say that in the Gemara, but he used to say like a hyena. Because in South Africa, when we used to go to the safaris, we learned how hyenas bite. We were told, this, the children and the cars going around on the safaris, keep your arms inside the car. Don't worry about leopards, don't worry about lions. You can recover from a bite by one of those guys. But if a hyena gets hold of your arm, he will crush your bones. And Rabbi Akiva used to say, a dog bites skin. I would bite like a donkey. I would crush the bones of a Talmid Chacham if I got hold of one. That was the hatred of Rabbi Akiva, who became our greatest light. And one of the things that turned him was when he sat as a shepherd watching water dripping on a stone. Remember the story? And he noticed that after years and years, centuries probably, of this drop of water dripping on the stone, it had made an indentation. And he said, if something as soft as water can impact on a stone, then something as powerful as Torah can impact on me. Torah, the wisdom of God, the wisdom of the Torah, can penetrate. And there was a realization that that could take place, but that needed 40 days of preparation. To master that power, to master that strength, you needed the 40 days that Moshe spent on Mount Sinai. So in these 40 days, there is a sense of the fact that Goliath will be fought not with a physical force, but with some form of spiritual force. The other interpretation is given is back to Orpah. Orpah, when she was making up her mind whether to follow her mother-in-law or to return, walked with her 40 steps. It was the 41st step that she turned back. And we're told that those 40 steps of company that she offered Orpah gave an extra 40 days of life to Goliath. But God remembered those 40 steps. And Goliath, as we know, is going to die in this battle. I'm telling you the end of the story, but you know the end of the story. Goliath is going to die. And his death is postponed 40 days in recognition of those 40 steps that Orpah took with Naomi. One has to understand the meticulous of God's desire to recognize even the simplest things we do, simplest kindnesses that cost us nothing, God takes very seriously and rewards us enormously for. So every morning and every evening he comes along, distracts the Jewish people. And then in verse 17, Yishai said to his son David, please take this ephah of toasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread for your brothers, and hurry to the camp to your brothers, and bring these 10 cheeses to the captain of the thousand, inquire after the welfare of your brothers, and obtain a report of their welfare. I want to know how they're doing. Take these gifts to them and come back. It's interesting. Again, a gift. What does Yishai really want? Yishai wants to know how his sons are. What would be the impact of him sending David to the sons? So David would arrive. The sons would say, what are you doing here? He would say, no, father just sent me to find out how you're doing. What would their interpretation be? Checking up on us?
Yeah.
Isn't that so? Send a gift. What are you doing here? I've come to bring you a gift. And by the way, how are you guys getting on? We're doing fine. Great. Father will be happy to hear that. So you get the same result without any bad feeling. If you're willing to be generous, if you're willing to give. It's like the leech and the attachment. You can attach yourself to somebody. You can get anything out of somebody if you do it through giving rather than through taking. Shaul, they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of the Elah fighting with the Plishtim. David arose early in the morning, left the sheep with a watchman, and set out as Yishai had commanded him. He came, it's important that he left the sheep with a watchman. So he has taken the necessary measures to make sure that his job as shepherd is taken care of, not neglecting the sheep. He came to the encirclement, and the army was going forth to do it to the battle line, shouting battle cries. Israel and the Philistines deployed battalions facing battalion. David left the baggage that was upon him with the keeper of the baggage and ran to the line. When he arrived, he inquired after the welfare of his brothers. As he was speaking to them, behold, the champion went forth from the Philistine battalions, Goliath the Philistine of Gath was his name, and spoke the above words, and David heard. All men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him, and they were very frightened. The men of Israel were saying, have you seen this man who goes forth? He goes forth to disgrace Israel. The king will enrich whoever kills him with great wealth, and give his daughter to him in marriage, and he will free his father's family from royal service in Israel. David spoke to the men standing with him, saying, what will be done for the man who slays the Philistine and removes disgrace from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he disgraces the battalions of the living God? So the people told him regarding this matter, saying, such and such shall be done for the man who kills him. So David's ears prick up when he hears this, the reward, and he says, just say that again. What did the king say? They say, marry his daughter, marry the king's daughter, and he'll enrich you. Eliab, his older brother, heard he was talking to the men, and Eliab became angry with David and said, why did you come down here, and with whom did you leave those sheep in the wilderness? I am aware of your willfulness and your evil thoughts, that you have come down here in order to watch the fighting. David replied, what have I done now? Was it not mere talk? And he then turned away from him towards someone else and said the same thing to him. And the people answered him as before. So once again he checked up. Why is he so interested in the reward? What is he doing this for, reward? Once again he says to the people, did you hear? What did the king offer? What did he say would happen to the man who beats Goliath? And again they say, marry his daughter and enrich him. The words David was saying became heard. People related them to Shaul, and he summoned David. David said to Shaul, let no man lose heart because of him. Your servant will go forth and fight this Philistine. But Shaul said to David, you cannot go forth to this Philistine stand to fight with him. You're a lad. Well, he was a warrior from his youth. And David said to Shaul, we learned this last week, your servant was a shepherd for his father among the flocks. The lion or the bear would come and carry off a sheep from the flock, and I would go after it, strike it down, and rescue the sheep from its mouth. If it would attack me, I would grab it to its beard and strike it and kill it. Your servant has slain even lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, for he has disgraced the battalion of the living God. Why does that make him like a lion or a bear? We discussed last week. He's threatening innocent people. Then David said, Hashem, who rescued me from the hand of the lion and from the hand of the bear, he will rescue me from this Philistine. What is the argument between Eliab and David? Eliab's comment is, what have you done with the sheep? And David's comment is, or at least David in his mind, it's not in his discussion with Eliab, but in his mind is, I've taken care of the sheep. I've put a watchman in charge of them. My issue now is to kill the Philistine. I'm here to save Israel. So look at the absurdity of it. Here you've got a man who is strategizing the salvation of Israel and the establishment of a new throne, and his brother is saying, what about the lambs? What have you done with them? They're just on two completely different wavelengths. How does this happen? What's it all about? Why is it that David gets excited, and why does he question so many times, what's the reward? What did the king say? David has an encounter in secret with Shmuel, the prophet. In that encounter, Shmuel anointed him king. Nobody knows about that. Shmuel knows about that, and David knows about that. He's still a young boy, young man. He knows that some way or other he's going to become king. Now, in Jewish thinking, you never leave anything to God. The only time you leave things to God is when you've done everything you can. When you have exerted all reasonable human effort, not desperate human effort. We're not allowed to do anything desperate because that implies a lack of trust. But nor are we allowed to be lazy. Nor are we allowed to leave things to God. God only extends us beyond the limits of our own ability. He does not substitute our own ability. God will not act instead of us. God will act with us. God will not help us if we're not doing our own thinking. God will not think for us. And nor should any rabbi think for us. We should think for ourselves. A Torah, a rabbi, a teacher will help us in that thinking process, provide us with instruments of thought and frameworks of thought. But we cannot delegate our thinking to any other authority. Nor can we delegate our actions to any other authority. Only at the point that we've reached the limits of our capability can we say, but God, there's still more, we can't go further and more needs to be done. We've exhausted every possibility. Then we can turn to God. And the image of that is the Jewish people standing in front of the Red Sea, the Egyptians chasing them from behind. God saying, go! The sea did not split until the first Jews were up to their mouths in the water. Then the sea split. The sea will not split until you're about to die. When you're about to die doing God's will, God will step in. But not while you're lying in bed planning your day. That's not when God's going to step in. God will only step in when we're in, up to our necks doing the right thing. Then he will go further. So David has to strategize now. And he's no longer strategizing about being a good shepherd. David has redefined the mission of his life. He's recreated his existence from shepherd to king. And he started to think in a completely different way. Now imagine this young man is walking through the crowds and overhears them saying that the man who kills Goliath marries the king's daughter. What goes through his mind? Passage to the throne. This has to be from God. This is opportunity. This is not threat. This is not danger. This is my opportunity of a lifetime. If I miss this, I miss the throne. I've just been told a few weeks ago that I'm going to be king. How am I going to get there? So one thing has happened already. Shaul has noticed me. I play music in his court. But that's not going to get me to the throne. There are lots of courtiers. All of a sudden there's an opportunity to marry the king's daughter. Surely that's a route to the throne? Surely I'm supposed to be listening more carefully? Phase one of his thinking. Phase two of his thinking is, yeah, but this man is impenetrable, Goliath. I'm a kid, I've never fought before. Well, one second, I have fought before. I fought a lion, and I fought a bear. How did I win those battles? I won those battles because of the passion of my conviction that those animals needed to be destroyed because they were threatening my innocent sheep. That's how I won that battle. I didn't win that battle with strength. A bear is stronger than a man. I didn't win that battle with energy and power. A lion has more energy and power than a man. I won that battle because I had something that no animal has got. Passion. Conviction, belief in my cause, and belief in a cause is more powerful than any army. Some of you might remember that very beautiful passage in War and Peace where General Kutuzov is trying to comfort his army after they've pulled out of Moscow, and Napoleon is moving forward, and they've deserted, they've left, and the soldiers feel this is the end of it, and he's as if planning the strategy, instructing them, very calm and very cool. And they say to him, what's going to happen? And he said, we're going to win. And they said, what do you mean we're winning? We're pulling up further and further. We've left the capital. What do you mean we're going to win? And he says, because we believe in what we're fighting for. We're defending our motherland. We'll fight with a passion that they will never be able to gain. And that passion is more powerful than any army. We've got to mobilize that passion and we'll evict them. That's the power of passion that emerges from conviction and a cause. And David realizes that. David realizes that the victory over the bear and the lion was driven not by energy and not by stature and not by power, but by the passion of a man's belief in the morality of his cause. If that's the case, says David, he's no different to a bear or a lion. Stronger than me, yes. More impenetrable than me, sure. More powerful than me, yes. More dangerous than me, yes. More experienced in warfare, yes. But he doesn't believe he's right. He's not fighting a war of moral conviction. I am. And I've seen the power of moral conviction. And if this is an opportunity from God, there's nobody more fit than I. Because I've experienced what one man can do. They fought as an army before. They've never fought as one man. They've never confronted a bear and a lion single-handedly. I have. I know that one man can destroy a bear, one man can destroy a lion, and one man can destroy Goliath, if God's behind you, and if you believe in the cause. Put one and one together. So here's an opportunity for my future, and I'm the best man to do it. There goes the volunteer. I'll do it. This must be from God. This is not coincidence. This must be from God, and therefore surely I'm going to win. Why else would God be doing this? Eliab doesn't see it. Eliab sees the shepherd, the little boy, the shepherd, having real talk with the soldiers. That's what he sees. He sees no opportunity. He sees nuisance. There's a very important book written in 1962 by Arthur Clarke called Profiles of the Future, an inquiry into the limits of the future. Now I'll read a few lines of it. Before I do so, let me refer you to one of the most valuable chazals, statements of the rabbi, of the rabbis, when they say in Pirkei Avos, Eizehu Chacham, what is the essence of wisdom? The answer is Hareya es hanolad, to see that which has been born. That's wisdom, not prophecy. It doesn't ask what is the essence of prophecy. That's normally translated as one who can see the future. That's not an accurate translation. Accurately, the translation is Hareya es hanolad, he who can see what has been born. Now you might say, but that's easy, to see something that's been born. Everybody's saying Mazel Tov. Do you have to be a chacham to know a baby was born? You're standing at a bris and you say, I'm a wise person. How you? I know that a boy was born. Of course you know. You're at a bris. Everybody's saying Mazel Tov. What does it take? Now, Ezra chacham is to know that something has been born at the moment of conception. Not at the moment of birth. That's too late. The time to know that something has been born is at the moment of conception. If you know it a day before conception, you're a prophet. That's not what we're talking about. To know it at conception, that's wisdom. Now let me read to you from Arthur Clarke. Two reasons why attempts to anticipate the future usually fall flat. First is failure of nerve, and the second is failure of imagination. Failure of nerve, he says, is the more predominant of the two. And failure of nerve occurs when, even given all the relevant facts, the would-be prophet, or in our case wise man, the would-be prophet cannot see that they point to an inescapable conclusion. Some of these failures are so ludicrous as to be almost unbelievable. But when you look back at history, the inability of people to recognize that things have changed is so ludicrous that it's almost unbelievable when you look back. But at the times, people will not see it. They will not see the changes taking place until it's too late, until you're well into the future, and then you look back and say, you know what, 50 years ago things changed, the world was never the same. You don't have to be a chacham to know that. You don't have to be a chacham to know that the First World War changed the world forever. You don't need to be a chacham to know that the 1960s changed the world forever. And you don't have to be a chacham to know in the year 2010 that the 1990s changed the world forever. The chacham is the person who now realizes that the world of yesterday doesn't exist anymore. It's gone. It's finished. Something like I used to say in South Africa before we left. I used to say years ago, I've emigrated already. Some people emigrate by leaving their country. I emigrated because my country left me. It changed, and you've got to recognize it's not the same place. Better, worse, form your own opinion, but it's not the same. It's what was is gone. Things have changed, and to realize that early enough and to understand the nature of that change, what does it require? It requires a very simple thing, and yet something so elusive. You notice change when you stand at the beginning of an event. Then your eyes are open, you're alert. Think of the opening of a movie. You're watching the title, trying to understand what it's going to mean. Those opening scenes, you're trying to figure out what do they mean, who are they, who are the characters, where is it all going to go. Very alert. Once you think you've grasped it and you understand what's happening, your attention starts to wane somewhat. And you're not focusing on detail to the same extent. And so it is in all situations. When you're at the beginning of an exercise, very alert, very focused. You sit down, you're writing an examination, the paper's handed out to you. Very focused, you read those questions, you look, your mind is spinning. As you get into it and your confidence starts coming and things start falling into place, the attention is not quite as focused. And when you're standing at the end of a process, your attention is at its lowest. There is the most confidence, almost arrogance, and sometimes arrogance, and least attention, and least attentiveness. The time of greatest attention is when you stand on the threshold of a new journey, not knowing where it's going to go. That's when you're looking at everything possible. Eliav sees David at the end of a career, or in the middle of a career, the career of a shepherd. David has redefined his career. I am no longer a shepherd, I'm a king elect. When you're at the opening of a new career, you notice opportunities. When you open a new business, you see opportunities. When you launch a new product, you see opportunities. When it's been going for a while, you miss opportunities. It's not that important to you, you're taking things for granted, things are rolling, and that's when businesses start to fail. Businesses don't fail when they're busy launching new products, if they're doing it sensibly and correctly. They don't fail, but very often, the most risky time is the time at which there is most excitement, most energy, most tension in a positive sense, most focus and most attention, because they're at the beginning of the launch of something new. The difference between Eliav and David is in one area. Eliav is unaware of the redefinition of David's mission. David has redefined his mission. So David stands at a new mission. I am king elect. What am I supposed to do? In John Kennedy's biography, they describe so beautifully the moment after the inauguration where he comes into the Oval Office and looks at this office and sits down at his desk and says to Pierre Salinger, "What is a president supposed to do?" And then the phone rang, he writes, and he never asked the question again. There is a moment at the beginning where, what am I supposed to do? Oh, the phone is ringing. That must be what the president is supposed to do. Let's question. Let's lift it up. Let's answer it. Let's see. There's that excitement to find out, what is a president supposed to do? Or what is anyone supposed to do when you're searching for new things, when you're looking for new opportunities? Your eyes are open, and everything is a potential opportunity. That's what youthfulness is. That's what a child is. As a child begins to walk, a child begins to crawl, a child begins to speak, a child begins to explore. That childishness of being at the origin of a new journey is what keeps us most alert for opportunities. And we can recreate that over and over again in our lives if we're only bright enough to realize when one thing has ended and a new thing has started. David realized he was at the beginning of a career. Eliav saw him in mid-career. In mid-career, there are no opportunities here. Your job is with the sheep. In the beginning of a new career, everything's an opportunity. Goliath's an opportunity. Shaul's daughter as a potential wife is an opportunity. Using his experience with the bear and with the lion is an opportunity. And David, as we said last week, is not a man to miss one opportunity in his life, because he knows very well that the real opportunities God sends once. Doesn't mean that you stop living if you don't get that one, but you don't get that opportunity again. Other opportunities, yes, but not that opportunity. That opportunity comes around once. And so David grasps the opportunity and he moves into it. There's one more point in dealing with this. There's this backwards and forwards discussion with the Philistine and with David. In verse 45, David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you with the name of Hashem, Master of Legions, the God of the battalions of Israel that you have ridiculed. On this day Hashem will deliver you into my hand. I'm not fighting you with my strength. I cannot do that. I shall smite you, and I will remove your head from upon you, and I shall offer the carcass of the Philistine camp this day to the fowl of the heavens and to the beast of the earth. Then the whole earth will know that there is God in Israel. And all this assembly will know that not through the sword and spear does Hashem grant salvation, for unto Hashem is the battle, and he shall deliver you into our hands." A little earlier than that, it's also quite interesting to see, in verse 43, the Philistine comments to David, they are hurling abuse at one another, and the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come after me with sticks?" Sees this young man coming along, what's he got in his hand? He's got a stick, no sword, no shield. He's hidden behind his back, the fact that he has a sling. But in his hand he has a stick. And Goliath says, am I a dog that you come after me with a stick? And Chazal say, here we see the essence of his feeling of degradation. I know that my mother Orpah had an orgy one night, and that I come from that. I know there was a dog there too, but I'm not the dog's son, and don't think I am. So this is on his mind all the time, that he's viewed as an animal. And the anger with which he sees that, the anger, that's the way he's viewed. And now he sees David come after him with a stick. That makes him really question himself and the way he's perceived by them. The anger ignites, David and him are hurling abuse. It happened then in verse 48 that when the Philistine arose and moved closer towards David, that David hurried and ran to the line towards the Philistine. David stretched his hand into the sack. He took a stone from there and slung it and struck the Philistine in the forehead. The stone penetrated his forehead and he fell upon his face upon the ground. Now, how the stone got in, flipped the little thing over his forehead and left a little gap, and David got the stone through that gap. But what's most interesting is the stone penetrated his forehead. How did that happen? And to hit him, okay, to knock him unconscious, alright, but to penetrate his forehead and actually go into his brain and kill him outright, one stone, that's a little strange. And there's an important piece of Zohar, a piece of Kabbalah that's important for you to hear. The Hebrew version and translate it as opposed to the Aramaic, it'll be a little easier. Kiran Shekasuv, as it explains, by Kalel Haplishti as David Ba'ilakav, that the Philistine cursed David by his God. So when this became a battle of gods, Mistakel by David the iron raw. David looked at Goliath with an iron raw. Now you've heard of iron horror and all that kind of thing. This is an iron raw with an evil eye. With a whole makom shedavid ayom mistakel ba'ayin raw. And if David applied the focus of that evil eye onto anyone, kol minei tzoras hayu nimshochim meino shel David. The spot at which David focused broke out in tzoras, which is commonly translated as leprosy. We don't know exactly what it was, but it's some kind of skin deterioration, of skin degeneration. Same applied to Yoav. Kiman shekilu es Hashem. The moment he cursed God, nistakel bo David ba'ayin ro, David looked at him with his eye, v'ro'o b'mitzchoy shenitztareya, and saw on his forehead a point that had become leprosy. Miyad v'atit bo ho'even b'nit b'mitzchoy. At that, the stone penetrated, sunk into his forehead. Because it hit him on the point of the tzarat. What's fascinating about this passage of Zohar is it's almost a laser beam kind of mentality. And the one questions, how did he get the stone into that point? Can you imagine if he had a laser gun? And there was just one little point that was open. And he could aim with a laser gun and shoot the stone down the laser gun. He would hit it spot on. There are many examples given, both in the Zohar and in the Gemara, of Torah being able to generate energy. Fire energy. Real heat energy. And of course we've got it at Sinai itself. At the giving of the Torah on Sinai, you have the fire and the thunder and the lightning and all of that kind of thing. And we discussed it, going back to one of the very early shiurim, we discussed the relationship between wisdom and energy. Just as there is a relationship which was not understood 100 years ago between energy and mass, energy and matter, so there is a relationship that is not yet understood between energy and wisdom. That wisdom can translate into energy. Just as David says, moral conviction, the passion of moral conviction, can translate into an energy that can overcome a lion and overcome a bear and overcome a Goliath. There is such energy in moral conviction that if David had the capacity to focus all of that total wisdom, tying back to the 40, on that one open aperture of his armor, and penetrate his skin, and weaken it, weaken the bone beneath that skin, and then fiery stone down that laser beam. Says the Zohar, that's the only way you'll understand this happening. This is not just the normal thing of a kid swinging a stone and by chance it happens to kill him. That's not what he was using. And we're told in the Zohar that the eye of David was a very fascinating eye. A very interesting comment, image. David's eye was made up of countless different colors. There wasn't an eye in the world as beautiful to look at as the eye of David. If you looked carefully at his eye, you would find every color in the world projected in that eye. And he would project the energy of that eye in love to anybody who had a moral conscience. But wicked people used to be terrified of that eye. We'll still have an opportunity as the character of David starts to unfold to understand what that colorfulness of eye meant. That capacity to look at the world through every conceivable color. That very opposite of black and white. That's what that color means. Most people are black and white in the way they see the world. Some have got a bit of gray. We call them broad-minded when they've got a bit of gray between the black and white. Here we're talking about somebody that had every imaginable color in the way he perceived the world. That was the extent of his wisdom and his depth of wisdom. He could evaluate every situation from a different angle, see things from completely different perspectives. But when he took all of that wisdom and focused it on 1 millimeter of a man's forehead, the penetrating energy that that created damaged the skull. And it was along that line of piercing directness that David was able to project his stone and to challenge Goliath. And here we have in this battle between the man who in his rejection and his sense of fall resorts to arrogance, resorts to physical brutality, facing a man who doesn't have the strength nor desire for physical brutality, but has been able to translate the passion and energy of wisdom and moral conviction into an energy more powerful than the most powerful of animals, decides to try and use his energy against this man, the biggest, mightiest man of all men, in his understanding that this is an opportunity sent to him to further his mission to become king of Israel, an opportunity to be recognized by the nation when he saves them, an opportunity to make the headlines in a way that promotes his career, an opportunity to carry out God's will, an opportunity to marry into the royal family and live by the king and watch the king and learn from the king and study the king and become schooled in the ways of royalty. This was an opportunity that he couldn't let go. And this, like every opportunity in David's life, was an opportunity that he did not let go. Thank you for your attention this evening, and we will meet again next week on Wednesday night. Is that right? Next week, Wednesday night, not Monday night. Monday night is Yom Tov.
Isn't that a fast day now?
It is, but the fast finishes. We're not going to force anybody to eat before the fast day is over. Yeah. So yes, sorry, ladies and gentlemen, we do have a sponsor this evening. As you know, the donations that you kindly make at the door don't cover the quality.